The following is a Srimad Bhagavatam class, 7th canto, 13th chapter, verse 44, given by Srila Rindasarup Das on April 9th, 1992, in Philadelphia.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
We're reading on Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 13, The Behavior of a Perfect Person, is text number 44. Translation. A learned, a thoughtful person must realize that material existence is illusion. This is possible only by self-realization. A self-realized person who has actually seen the truth should retire from all material activities, being situated in self-realization. Srila Prabhupada's purport. By an analytical study of the entire constitution of the body, one can surely come to the conclusion that the soul is different from all the body's material constituents, such as earth, water, fire, and air. Thus, the difference between the body and soul can be realized by a person who is thoughtful, manisi or muni. And after this realization of the individual spirit soul, one can very easily understand the supreme spirit soul. If one thus realizes that the individual soul is subordinate to the supreme spirit soul, he achieves self-realization. As explained in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there are two souls within the body. The body is called kshetra, and there are two kshetra gyan, or occupants of the body, namely the super soul, paramatma, and the individual soul. The super soul and the individual soul are like two birds sitting on the same tree, the material body. One bird, the individual, forgetful bird, is eating the fruit of the tree, not caring for the instructions of the other bird, which is only a witness to the activities of the first bird, who is his friend. When the forgetful bird comes to understand the supreme friend, who is always with him and trying to give him guidance in different bodies, he takes shelter at the lotus feet of that supreme bird. As explained in the yoga process, dhyanavastita tadgatena manasa pashyanti yam yoginaha. When one actually becomes a perfect yogi, by meditation he can see the supreme friend and surrender unto him. This is the beginning of bhakti yoga, or actual life in Krishna consciousness. Atmano bhuta tam maya duhuyat sachadrin munihi tato niriho viramet svanubhut atmani stitaha. A learned, thoughtful person must realize that material existence is illusion. This is only possible by self-realization. A self-realized person who has actually seen the truth should retire from all material activities, being situated in self-realization. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada is concerned to explain what is meant by self-realization. And he takes us through several stages. The first part is understanding the difference between the soul and the material body. He says, by analytical study of the entire constitution of the body, one can surely come to the conclusion that the soul is different from all the body's material constituents. So that's the first stage in this way, is understanding, being able to by analysis or by analytical introspection separate out the soul from the body. The key to this process is to understand that the soul is the knower and the body is the known. Here, as explained in the 13th chapter, the body is called Kshetra, that is to say, the field of activities. Our field, the field of activities of the soul, is not what we like to call the environment, that is, what's external to the skin, but rather the actual environment is the body, and the knower is the soul. In a way, it's an analogy. Kshetra and Kshetrakya, the field of activities and the knower of the field of activities. So you may think of a person situated in a certain marked off, demarcated geographical area. So this is his field, say his field for agricultural cultivation or whatever. And then he's the one that works and knows this field. That's based on the bodily conception of the self. In normal, conventional language and way of speaking, we think of the self as the body. And the boundary between the self and what is not the self is situated at the skin. Is the boundary layer. So there's me and there's my environment. The environment is the kshetra. But by analytical study, we have to push the division between the self and the not-self back. Here we're thinking of ourselves as the knower. I am the subject, and by I mean this body. This is conventional. We say, for example, if I cut my finger, I hurt myself. And even in Sanskrit, the word atma, meaning self, can refer to the body because of this conventional way of speaking. As the body, as the self. But one has to proceed by analytical study and understand what the environment really is, what is the not-self. The self is the knower, kshetra, gyan, that which is conscious, because the symptom of the presence of the soul is consciousness. And what the soul is conscious of, the contents of his consciousness, is everything else. So just by a little introspection, we can understand that here my body is made of these elements, from subtle to gross, or of space and fire, water, earth, and air. Earth, air, fire, water, ether, right? These are the five elements, which Bhakti Siddhanta very cleverly describes as solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. When we say to people, when we're preaching Krishna consciousness, I had this last night at this church, same thing, I mentioned earth, air, fire, water, ether. And then I said, but we'll call them solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. These are the five gross elements. It's good to know this classification, because they go from gross to subtle. Gross means more perceptible to the senses. Subtle means less and less easily perceived. And you include something as an element, space, which people don't normally think of as an element. They think of it as a vacuum or a void. However, it's easy enough to point out to people that, in fact, empty space or space is not a void or vacuum. For example, it bends. This is according to modern physics. It bends. Gravitational forces bend space. It takes lots and lots of mathematics to describe curvatures of space. So space has this attribute that it's plastic. I don't pretend to understand this, but this is general relativity theory. Huh? And in quantum mechanics, I'm told by authorities like Sariputta, that if you describe empty space in quantum mechanics, it takes pages of mathematical formulas. So it is not nothing. But it's subtle. So these elements, earth, water, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, space, they make up the elements of our gross body. So we can see that, for example, they're working together to form things. So I say I see, when I see I'm referring to the act of my eyes. But really there's another seeing, so to speak, which is that I am conscious of my eyes seeing. So that not only are my eyes seeing, but I'm conscious of my eyes seeing, I'm conscious of my tongue tasting, I'm conscious of my ears hearing. So this way the knower is actually the consciousness, and what I'm conscious of is the operations of these organs of the body, bringing to me information from the world beyond my skin, and from bringing me information from my own body. So I'm the knower, and that body is also the not-self. This body is also the environment. Sometimes the environment is pleasant, sometimes the environment is unpleasant. We're always receiving messages from our body, and any messages we get from out there are mediated through this body. Just as we have seen that the material elements go from gross to subtle, earth, air, fire, water, ether, then there's three even subtler: mind, intelligence, false ego. Here, when you come to the shukshma sharira, shukshma means subtle, a subtle body. This is important when we discuss this with Western people, because everywhere they mind and soul are confused. There is no precise or commonly agreed on idea of soul. Most people think of it as a meaningless term. Some of them think of it as a metaphor, and a lot of people think of it as a synonym for mind. And in philosophy, they're used interchangeably. Or they're thought to be the same entity, somehow or other. But here, these are the material elements, mind, intelligence, and false ego, which mean that they also go on the not-self side of the equation. They also go over there. We identify more closely even with our mind than we do with our gross body. People may a disease of the gross body, they can maybe tolerate a disease of the subtle body. A mental disturbance or dysfunction is much more frightening to people because they have a feeling of personal disintegration. Also, when you lose limbs in an automobile accident, there's also a feeling of personal disintegration. But somehow or other, you can get it together. But if you lose a chunk of mental function, and then you think, oh, this is really happening to me, when there's memory loss, or those very strange kinds of things that happen to people with neurological disorders, and they live in a very sometimes strange world, where they could do something with their left hand and they do something with the right hand and they're like two separate people, and all these other kinds of things. Or some people with brain damage who live in a perpetual, their memory only lasts 15 minutes. And so the man spends his whole life reading the same Reader's Digest article over and over again, and each time he reads it, it's brand new. You know, these kinds of things, which just show a disorder of the close-in, subtle body. It has also become affected in some such way. Or maybe not affected. It's a little hard to say what's actually going on. He may be all there in the subtle body, but just can't communicate because of a defective brain mechanism. But anyway, these disorders of the subtle body, we take them more as happening to us. But still, we are also the witness of the functioning of our own mind. With introspection, we can watch our mind works this way, our mind works that way. It has its own inertia, has its own tendencies. And so we can also witness our own mind working and our own intelligence working and our own false ego. All these things we can also see. So we are the seer. And what we are seeing is not self. The self is the seer. And what he sees is the not self. So in this way, we bring the boundary between the self and the not-self back in. From the boundary between the gross body and the outside world, to the boundary between the subtle body and the gross body, and then back in between the soul, consciousness. So this is the self. The self is pure awareness. Pure perspective. Just this being the subject of experiences. People will sometimes argue, like Buddhist philosophers, that there is no self. That there is only a succession of changes. That our mind and our body flows like a river. And all we see is a succession of events. And there's no constant or steady entity that we can call a self. But in our experience in our lives, with my particular mind and particular body, and so my body goes through changes and my mind goes through changes all the time. Say I'm very volatile. And every week I say, I'm not the same person I was last week. Divorce my wife, get some, I'm a different person. I'm not really, you know. Which people do all the time based on this philosophy that I'm not the same person. They feel obliged, they feel free to avoid all kinds of obligations. When I got married at 20, I wasn't the same person I am now. So I didn't commit myself. I only committed that 20-year-old, but now that I'm so different at 25, how can I be bound by the commitment made by that previous entity? That kind of philosophy is there. So this is the notion that there is no self. But say in my life that these things are going on, say the mind is constantly changing, still all of those changes are happening to me. I am the consciousness, the witness is there to make these experiences my experiences. So that awareness, that consciousness, that state of being a subject to whom things happen, that is the soul. Even though everything else changes, the one soul remains through all those changes as just the bare witness, the knower of all these activities. Naturally, he feels he himself is changing because he's identified with these processes. But if one actually becomes detached, then he can understand gradually that I'm the same person and that I'm sitting in this environment of the body and the mind that constantly goes through changes, but I myself actually don't change at all. So this way, one can come to understand, separate himself off analytically as the seer or the knower or the witness who sees besides himself gross and subtle matter. Then Prabhupada says, next step is to understand that there's not one seer, but two. There's the seer and the superseer, or overseer, called in 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Upadrashta, overseer, and permitter. These are the functions. How do we come to understand the superseer is there, or the overseer is there? We can understand, first of all, that there has to be some coordinating agency, that I am situated in this body and mind, that it is acting in different ways, that if I look, I can see that actually I have no power to make it act or perform as I will. It simply somehow or other obeys my command. I desire to lift my arm lifts. I don't know how it happens. So many things are going on that this field is providing for me so many things. And there has to be some agent of relation who keeps together the soul and this field of activity, who's controlling the whole arrangement around me. That agent is the super soul, who's there in the body along with the self, and who gives direction and guidance to the self. So there's two occupants of this body. Shastra tells us, yes, look for him. Look for this other person. Try to understand that we are operating by receiving directions or instructions or inspiration to do things and to go in certain ways by a higher agency. And that higher agency, when it becomes known, becomes manifest as the super soul. So here in the 13th chapter, the existence of the super soul is made quite clear. Nature and joy of the calm, where it talks about the field and the gnawer of the field. So just in case you think there's only one knower, Krishna very clearly discusses this this super soul. Upadras tanumanta cha bharta bhokta maheshwaraha paramatmeti chatto dehismin kurusha paraha. Yet in this body there is another transcendental enjoyer who is the Lord, the supreme proprietor, who exists as the overseer and permitter, and who is known as the super soul. This is very clearly, Upadrasta, overseer, Anumanta, permitter, Bharta, master, Bhokta, enjoyer, Maha Ishwaraha, the Supreme Lord, Parama Atma, the Super Soul. And he's referred to as Purusha Paraha, a supreme person. So that supreme person is there along with the self and the within the material world. And we have here that Prabhupada mentions this, the allegory given in the Svetashvatara Upanishad of the two birds sitting in the same tree, one of whom eats the fruits, which have two flavors, two tastes, sweet and bitter. And the other bird who is simply watching. So the living entity or the conditioned soul is trying to enjoy in the material world and experiences happiness and distress. Whereas the other soul in the body is aloof at all times. He's simply the witness. And he accompanies this other bird as he hops from branch to branch. That is, goes from body to body to body. The super soul goes along with him and makes all the arrangements for that living entity and to operate in the material world. He also makes the arrangement for the living entity to come back to him when he's ready. So this is self-realization. To know matter, to know spirit, and to know the origin and controller of both. And one can go further, one step further. As Prabhupada says, when one becomes a perfect yogi, by meditation he can see the supreme friend and surrender to him. That's Paramatma realization. Supreme friend means the Paramatma. The helper and partner of the living entity who's situated in his heart, going along with him with a very friendly attitude, suhit, a well-wishing friend. One surrenders to him. Then there's realization of the super soul feature of the Lord. The Prabhupada says this is the beginning of bhakti yoga, or actual life in Krishna consciousness. Because one can also understand that the super soul feature is not sufficient to express the greatness of the Supreme Person. Because all the super soul is simply the order supplier for the living entity. That's his function, to go along with the living entities and make arrangements for his satisfaction of his desires. He's controlling the material energy. So the Supreme has to be something much more than that. So we can understand that that super soul is just a partial aspect. Eka Amsha, Krishna says, a single fragment of myself is a partial aspect of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is enjoying with his own internal potencies. The super soul is not enjoying with his own internal potencies. He's acting as the order supplier for the living entity. So in his feature as Bhagavan, the Absolute Truth is there enjoying in his own kingdom, experiencing bliss with his internal potencies, and is not really involved at all with anything to do with the material energy. It simply consorts with the internal potency. So that's full self-realization. So any questions? But in this verse, we see how this Brahmana describes Krishna consciousness from the perspective of introspective yoga. But in his purport, Prabhupada shows how it comes to the same point of Krishna consciousness. And we discussed this yesterday about becoming detached from the material world, and gradually by an introspective process withdrawing from the activities of gross and subtle matter and giving them back over again to their source, and that way becoming completely detached. Yeah.
So through that you can get to know the super soul.
Yeah.
I was wondering, why is it so difficult to know the super soul when you're so close to a normal soul?
Because you're busy not knowing him. Prabhupada said at one point it's hard to wake up somebody who's pretending to be asleep. The living entity doesn't know the super soul because he's really in the business. To know the super soul, one has to be willing to take direction from the super soul, because that's what it means. He's my superior and the one who gives me direction. If I'm embarking on a career, which basically I'm saying I'm the supreme, then you don't want to know that there's somebody with you very close who in fact is the supreme. So you say, I don't want to know the super soul. He very obligingly keeps you ignorant of his existence. And it takes a special miracle to make us ignorant of Krishna, make us ignorant of the super soul. That special miracle by which you become so stupid is given by Krishna. In fulfillment of our desires, I'm situated in everyone's heart, he says, and from me comes remembrance and knowledge and forgetfulness. So it's a matter of our desire, and it's a matter of the super soul as the order supplier and fulfilling that desire. So it's actually all atheists are created by God at their request. And they can have infallible experience of the non-existence of God by God's grace. That's where it goes. That's where it takes place. That's how. So if Krishna wants to conceal himself, you'll never find him. Well, actually, once we want to find him, then he reveals himself. He makes himself known. It depends on our disposition towards Krishna. Our real disposition, not just what we may say out of conventional piety. Oh yes, I love God, and then proceed in a different manner to still be the enjoyer, the controller. But what we really feel about Krishna, really, really feel, and that he takes into account. Because you can't deceive Super Soul. We may deceive everybody else around us, and of course we deceive ourselves, but you can't deceive Super Soul.
You change what you feel internally about Krishna by doing a proper process.
Yeah, usually. Uh-huh. Yeah, we make a kind of preliminary decision that we want to change, and then we have to keep ourselves from going back on it and following through with the implications. I want to surrender to Krishna, and then we say, but not yet, in a little while. I want to surrender to Krishna gradually. I want to surrender to him, so I like that. Sometimes we're more attracted to the ideal of surrender to Krishna, but not so much attracted to the actual practice. So it takes a little time to become determined to surrender to Krishna. But once we turn toward Krishna, start back, then he helps us. And Prabhupada says that for every step we take toward Krishna, one step we take, he'll take 10 toward us. That's how a lot of people go back to Godhead, kicking and screaming in protest. In other words, Krishna sometimes gives them no choice out of his kindness. Once they've turned toward Krishna and decide to come back, and then they fall victim to the material energy in so many different ways. Krishna really, he's very kind, and he makes their lives miserable. That's why people like to worship demigods sometimes. Yes.
In retrospect, it often so usually seems to me that Christians may all be righteous. In other words, the step that I may make, these arrangements you make, and then.
Yeah, the enablement comes from Krishna. Although somewhere from ourselves comes a decision. That has to be. We're the originator of the decision to go toward Krishna. And then the follow-through is immediate. On Krishna's side, immediately. Because he's depicted as waiting for that decision, waiting for the living entity to finally understand somewhere that Krishna, I've turned away from you, faced outside toward the external potency. I've turned around, now I'm going to turn back around toward you again. He's waiting for that decision. So as soon as it's there, he makes everything all set. Yeah. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
But it almost seems as though the individual decision has been made. I appreciate it. I've never been able to see that I did anything in the process that wasn't pure gift.
But say the gift is, yeah, but say the gift is there for everybody. But some take it and some don't.
But you only see it on the level of analysis.
Yeah, on the level of experience, no one will see that this is where I turned to Krishna, because you won't be able to see it until you've seen it begin to become manifest. And that manifestation is made possible by Krishna's mercy. It's like this. Here's an example. A government, for example, will have a contingency plan. They always have contingency plans. The Pentagon, for example, has plans for 20 different wars. And so when immediately something happens, the plan is, they know exactly what to do. It's all set. They don't have to think twice. You know, bang, bang, bang. As soon as, Iran declares war on the United States, it's immediately, everybody knows what to do. So Krishna is ready for every individual soul. The world is so arranged that as soon as that soul turns, even without his own knowledge, and because it won't be apparent, it happens so deep within the heart that he may not know, but still Krishna's got the plan. Goes immediately into action, just waiting. But when we say that the living entity has free will, that's what it means. It has to be the living entity's actual decision for which he's responsible, somehow or other. Of course, he's always getting pressure from Krishna in some way. The pressure is there from the material world that you can't enjoy independently of Krishna. And so Krishna is always trying to nudge him. But not nudge him so much that he interferes with the freedom of the living entity to, in fact, remain turned away from him. If that's what you want, that's what we get. And that's why the world goes on like it is. Anything else? Our glorious Srila Prabhupada.